teenagers are lazy, ill-informed, and apathetic when it comes to politics, right? Well, those are the stereotypes that Andrew Demeter, a teenage journalist from Cleveland, is trying to change. He's a high school junior. He's already known for his confrontation with Nancy Pelosi for her stance on the NSA. Take a listen.
Why do you support the NSA's illegal and ubiquitous data collection?
Well, I have questions about the metadata collection that they were collecting unless they had a reason to do so.
You did vote for a bill to continue funding for the NSA, though.
Yeah, of course. I don't think we should not fund the National Security Agency. No, they do many,
things. Isn't the NSA a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment?
No. Some of what they do should be subjected to scrutiny in some of the things.
Well, now the 16-year-old is setting his sights on crowdfunding his youth news network called Politicast. The online news network will specifically target the youth of America and will feature national and international correspondents and stories. And Andrew joined me earlier today, and I asked him what inspired him to pursue this news project.
I'd probably have to say that just the youth is the literal future of our country and our world, and it's just so disconcerting right now here in America. You know, teens or people just can't vote until they're 18. So my thought process is that if you can't vote until then, people kind of think apathetically, hey, why should I even bother to understand politics? And with Politicast, that's something that we want to change.
Hi, my name is Andrew Demeter. I'm a 16-year-old independent journalist based in Cleveland, Ohio. And yes, I'm that teen who confronted former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi last month. But today, I want to talk about a new project that I'm super excited about. See, America's youth is the literal future of our country. Despite this fact, we, as teens, view politics as boring and confusing, difficult to understand. Why should we care? After all, how can we possibly expect our voices to be heard when we can't even vote until we're 18? Not all the youth is politically apathetic, though. The goal of this Indiegogo campaign is simple: to provide teens already interested in politics, but who lack a voice, with the platform necessary to effectively communicate their political opinions and solutions to the world. We'll then harness the global reach and influence of social media by syndicating content to inactive teens who will, in turn, begin developing an interest in politics. To actualize this concept, we'll launch the world's first ever political news outlet run entirely by teenagers. We'll call it
Politicast.
We'll build a professional TV studio complete with cameras, computers, lighting, a news desk, etc. to produce live HD broadcasts with guests, in-studio anchors, and national, even international, on-location reporters. As individuals, we're biased, but together our opinions will span the entire political spectrum, liberal to conservative, moderate to radical. Coverage will be clear, digestible, and coherent, rendering vital information accessible and easy to understand. We'll simplify the buzzwords and bureaucratic language of both mainstream media and government. You'll get news from reporters, not repeaters. Most importantly, we're fearless. We'll ask real, pressing questions and get answers. Look, we are living in extraordinary times. With your help, we can empower our youth, our future. Together, we can accomplish unbelievable things with a little help from a lot of people. Thank you so much for supporting this project and making it happen.
Hi, Andrew. How you doing?
Hey, Brett. Thanks for having me on again. Really appreciate it. I know just in the intro there, we were talking about how I was on in the past, and we have a lot to discuss because I think a lot has changed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So just to bring people up to speed, if they haven't heard that episode, they can go back if they want to. And I don't know if you'd recommend this, but they can hear you on School Sucks podcast number 193. It was called A High School Freshman Wakes Up and Speaks Out. We talked about the influences that you had, who inspired you to start your YouTube channel, Teen Take, which a listener had sent me just a couple weeks before. This was back in February of 2013, and I was really impressed with your production qualities. And you were, it was brand new. You had like probably 7 or 8 videos at the time. So You talked about being very influenced, and we got into this on the show a little bit, by Alex Jones and Jesse Ventura. And I think later we also talked about Adam Kokesh. you know, almost 18 months have gone by. Have you added any names? Have you, because I remember at the end of the show, I said, oh, you know, check out Free Domain Radio and maybe a couple other suggestions as well. So are you adding to your list of influences at this point?
Most definitely I am. I'm always, as I get busier and everything with creating this content, it gets a little more tougher. You have to be producing more than you're consuming, but I didn't know you actually mentioned Free Domain Radio last time I was on because maybe I wasn't paying attention or something, but yeah, I've been watching Stefan's videos for a long time now, so... So whether or not you told me that or whether or not I was paying attention when you said that, but yeah, Stefan does some great stuff. And so, yeah, he's one of the other influences I've added. I guess it's going to be a divisive figure that's kind of, you know, I wouldn't call them inspirations either because, I don't know, that just isn't a word I'm too fond of, I guess. But also Glenn Beck on some of his stuff. You know, I'm not saying I'm in full support of him or whatever, but some of the stuff he's done as far as the border's concerned, and I know I'm probably holding a much different stance than some of your listeners with the border and some of the actions, like I said, that Glenn Beck has taken. And also his stance on what's going on in Iraq. Mm-hmm. I actually made a video on that a while back that I've yet to release. So Glenn Beck and definitely Stefan. And, I still listen to Alex Jones every now and again. And that's pretty much
it. And you've checked out some School Sucks in the past year as well?
Yeah, I've definitely seen a couple scroll down my Facebook feed and stuff. So, yeah, love the work that you guys are doing as well.
Thank you. So let me just ask, because I bet there's people in the audience who are curious about this. Glenn Beck took basically an anti-U.S. intervention stance at this point in Iraq. And didn't he even basically apologize for initially supporting the Iraq war back in 2003, 2004?
Yeah, he did. I wish I had the quote right in front of me here, but I do say it in the video that I made, and I hope to release this video very soon. Not that we're going to pull out of Iraq anytime soon, because I know it'll probably be relevant for some
sure.
time to come. But yeah, so Glenn Beck, that's just one thing that he did that, I was just really surprised by, I guess, almost, and I thought it was really brave of him to do. But again, I haven't looked too deep into Glenn Beck or whatever, but I know some people aren't his biggest fans, but I was watching some of his older stuff that he did on Fox too, and I was pretty impressed, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, back when you were probably in elementary school, he was actually on CNN. I think mm-hmm. that was where he first came on the scene, and that didn't last long. And eventually, you know, when he started talking, I remember he started talking about the Federal Reserve and he started talking about like the early 20th century progressives. And that's dangerous territory. It wasn't long after that that he was off Fox. So I'm impressed with what he's been able to do. And obviously, I think while I'm certainly like you, don't agree with everything that he says, seems like he's learned his way out of the mainstream media. Which is definitely one of the themes that mm-hmm. we're gonna talk about today. Tell me a little bit about your stance on this border issue, because I feel like I've almost I have this attitude about immigration, and I've almost washed my hands of the whole issue. I haven't really paid too much attention to what's going on. So where's Beck on that? Where are you on that? I'm actually interested to just capture that.
Yeah, to be honest, I haven't, researched as much as I should have on the border crisis as well. Like I said, I've just been so busy, which is no excuse to be ill-informed on current events. But my stance on the border crisis, if it is a crisis, deemed by some, is that I don't think we should be calling these people illegals, of course. I made like a video and just put it on private on my YouTube page. Mm-hmm. I made a video about this. Now, of course, you know, we have the First Amendment, of course, so people can say what they like. But personally, I don't view these people as illegal or alien.
you know, or maybe they're illegal, I guess you could stretch that, but they're definitely not alien. They're our fellow human beings. I don't think that we should base who we like and who we dislike based on, borders which are arbitrarily drawn by government. Mm-hmm. And so I think people should be free to cross wherever they like. Now, my kind of agreement or concurrence with the people who are anti-immigration and stuff, illegal immigration, because there is a legal way to do this, of course, but I think anyone should be able to cross the border so long as government doesn't provide for their needs, because this was one of the points that I addressed also. I think that anyone can go wherever they like, but government shouldn't be providing for their needs like we've seen in some instances with this border crisis again. So I guess that's where you'd kind of have to draw the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. My one issue, I guess one of maybe a few issues that I've had with conservatives on the immigration issue is that conservatives generally do a good job talking about the size and efficiency of government. You know, there's too many laws, there's too much bureaucracy. But in this immigration department, everything is couched in legality, right? That these people shouldn't be doing this because it's illegal, as if for some strange reason, immigration is just this strange place in government where there's the perfect amount of laws and the perfect amount of bureaucracy. And if you can't, you know, get in line with all of it, you're a bad person. You're an illegal. But I know that Beck even came around on that a little bit, and that he was actually trying to help some of these people who found themselves in this crisis down at the southern border, right?
Right. It's like these people are our fellow humans on this earth. We don't need to be calling them these names. Again, you have every right to. I'm not saying you don't. And just all this violence and these protests and everything. It's like, again, should our government be providing for their needs? No, I don't think so. But should they have the right to come over into America if they like? Yes. And if they can, in line with the free market, provide a utility to an employer at a lower wage or something like that, should they be able to take our jobs? In my opinion, theoretically, yes. So, mm-hmm. That's the free market at work, in my opinion. And, you know, these people say, oh, well, you know, they'll take my job. I don't see that to be very valid.
Right. Absolutely. So you credit Beck now as an influence. And one of the reasons why I wanted to flesh that out a little bit better for my audience is if people haven't checked in with Beck since, like, say, I don't know, 2007, 2008, when he's on Fox
right.
making fun of Ron Paul, there's been a lot of developments. And obviously, he's still a work in progress. I know a couple years ago, he basically asked libertarians for their forgiveness and their acceptance of him. So also, as far as updates are concerned, you were a freshman the last time we interviewed you. You've just started your junior year?
Correct.
Okay, so you're 16, 17 now?
16.
Right. When we talked before, you had a pretty small YouTube channel, right? And maybe a couple thousand subscribers. At this point, mm-hmm. like 3 days ago, you were on RT with Manila Chan. A few months ago, you were on InfoWars Nightly News with Leanne McAdoo. You've had articles written about you in The Blaze. You won a C-SPAN video contest. And we can talk about all of that, but that leads to this question. What's changed at school? I mean, you've got some notoriety now. Have you continued to try and share things with peers? Have you connected with anybody? Have you won anybody over?
Yeah, Brett, I think it really comes full circle now that you actually go back to that. So as far as, you know, waking people up and everything, I have still tried with some debates, even though they're just kind of heated conversations, I guess, with some people. So I've still tried to do that. But basically the beginning of where all this media coverage and explosion almost of my YouTube channel, although I still only have like a few thousand subscribers and everything, mm-hmm. but it's kind of twofold. The first part was producing a documentary, even though it's really technically a micro documentary. It was only about 7 minutes because it had to be for this documentary competition that C-SPAN annually hosts, and that's called Student Cam, and it's for middle to high school students, and basically they have a prompt every year that you respond to and make a video about. You do interviews and stuff like that. And the one from this past year in 2014 was, what's one important issue Congress should address in 2014? So I was originally gonna do something like the NDAA or drones or something like that. But then, unfortunately, I called a few people for interviews or just to, you know, see if they'd be interested in interviews. I called some Congress people, talked with their secretaries and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And needless to say, that really didn't go over too well, and I didn't get too many volunteers. So eventually, I revised the topic, or changed it completely, actually, to GMOs, genetically modified organisms, which has been something that I've been pretty vocal about in the past. And once I did that, even, people still weren't willing to talk about it. But I did manage to interview a farmer, a grocer, actually a lady from the USDA that wasn't included in the documentary, because long story short, she was reading from this basic script that, from what I presume, her boss gave her. And she essentially looked like a robot, so I didn't really include her in the video.
Right.
And I also interviewed Ben Swan, a great investigative reporter from Cincinnati, and an author, a public health specialist, and stuff like that. So that was the documentary that I created. I, again, reached out to politicians, spokespeople at Monsanto, with no avail. So that was disappointing, but not unexpected. So anyways, I won that competition. I got first prize out of like 2,300 entries. And so then the second part of that is that the top four winners, top five winners, my memory's, you know, it's early in the morning. So then the top five winners, C-SPAN, actually flew down to Washington, D.C., or if they were in the South, they flew them up to Washington, D.C. And when we were there, we had like a three-day business-type thing there, I guess, because it wasn't really a vacation. So we were in D.C. for 3 days. One of the days we were on C-SPAN. We did this roundtable discussion, and that aired on TV. And then the other day, I'm not quite sure what we did. And then the last day, which was where this next part kind of dovetails with, is we got to meet with House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, also former Speaker of the House. And then when we were there, each person who entered the competition, each contestant got to ask her one question, and one question relevant to their documentary. And although mine was on GMOs, I actually asked her a question about the NSA.
Yes.
So my question verbatim was, why do you support the NSA's illegal and ubiquitous data collection, referring to, of course, the surveillance state and Big Brother and everything? So she essentially responded, I mean, you can go see the video online at youtube.com/teentake, but she responded first with no coherent answer, and secondly, just essentially blaming the Bush administration, which is ironic because Bush signed into law the Patriot Act, and then the Obama administration essentially just expanded that with the NSA that Pelosi supports, even though she doesn't really provide any explanation as to why she does. So that's pretty much been what happened. And then after that whole confrontation with Pelosi, Fox News picked it up, and some local news outlets as well. So I got to do some interviews like that. And then I recently launched Politicast, of course, which we can talk about. And that got me on RT again, and I think that brings people pretty much up to speed.
Yeah, and how has that? So let's. I want to put a bookmark in. First of all, this Pelosi video and the "We the People Genetically Modified" was the video that won the contest, right?
Correct.
Okay, so let's put a bookmark there because I want to come back and talk about those two videos for a minute. But what has that translated into with, you know, school teachers, other people in your life, as far as credibility, all of this exposure, has there been any changes there? Because I think initially when you first start talking to people about this, at least from my own experience, people are like, yeah, whatever, or you're crazy, or at the very least, let's talk about, you know, sports because you're choices of topic make me uncomfortable. So with this exposure, what's changed in those environments?
Well, since most of this happened during the summer, you know, I haven't really had a chance to get back into school yet. I actually just started this past Thursday, so I've only had 2 days actually. But I was actually telling one of my teachers the other day. He asked what did you do during the summer? So I told him he was unaware, because like I said, a ton of people actually were, which kind of contrasts what I just said, but I was on Fox News, so many people, and local television, so many people had actually seen what I did, but he had not, so I saw him write down the name of the video, Teen Confronts Pelosi, on a piece of paper, and then the next morning I actually heard another teacher say, oh, you know, I heard about this, I have to check it out. So you know, whether or not they agree or disagree, I think it is at least important that they're seeing that this youth demographic is interested, and they are taking action, asking questions that mainstream media won't dare ask because they don't want to put their job on the line. So,
sure.
So as far as from the teacher perspective and credibility, not much has changed, but as far as students and peers and everything, I'm not sure how much more interest they are in politics, if at all. But at least, you know, sometimes on Instagram or Facebook, I'll post a screen grab of like an interview I've done, like on RT or whatever. And they'll see that and they'll say, hey, you know, one of my friends is on TV or whatever. So I think that's an interesting prospect mm-hmm. for them. And maybe, you know, it gets them a little more interested in politics or current events, hopefully. But, you know, I can't speak from their perspective, but that's what I perceive.
Sure. And if we can, I'd like to return to the discussion of these two videos, the short documentary that you made about GMOs. And of course, this video that has between 700,000 and 800,000 views, mm-hmm. right? The Pelosi question that you asked. It's interesting, right? And it's kind of like, I could almost see it as kind of frustrating from my point of view. You put so much work into these videos that you put on Teen Take. I saw an article where you were interviewed about the contest and you estimated that you worked on the video for like 150 hours,
mm-hmm.
4 weeks of work, you know, full time. Well, you're, you know, a full-time student as well.
Mm-hmm.
But then you make a video, or you didn't even make a video. All somebody had to do was point a camera at you while you happen to be in front of Nancy Pelosi and while you happen to be a curious teenager, which I guess is also rare. Not that all teenagers don't have that, but it's kind of schooled out of us, at least for a while. This video, with minimal effort, minimal time, that's probably your most viral video, mm-hmm. right, on your channel.
Yeah, it's funny you actually mentioned that. It's just someone pointing a camera at me. I actually had two angles of that video, one being my cell phone camera, the other being a camera from C-SPAN. They had a cameraman there. And it's like a whole backstory just beyond, you know, the surface that is the video. And I released a press release that went along with it as well. And it was just a whole hassle in and of itself to actually get the footage that you're seeing, because when I was recording the video, problem was I recorded what I thought was the whole video, which was about 8 minutes, because I started recording a couple minutes before so I wouldn't miss anything. And then halfway mm-hmm. through, when I'm like asking the climactic question of the confrontation, even though my phone didn't show it until I reviewed the footage later, my phone stopped recording and it ran out of storage, you know? So just my luck.
Mm-hmm.
So then I saw C-SPAN at a camera there, so I was like, oh, great. Even though my phone, you know, failed to record this whole thing, at least there's something else. So thank God they have a camera. And then after the whole confrontation, one of C-SPAN's employees approached me and said, you know, hey, I saw you were recording that. Again, this was before he knew I hadn't recorded the entire thing. And he said, were you planning on posting that on YouTube? And I said, well, you know, maybe. Why do you care? And this was, again, I still thought I had the whole recording, too. And he essentially said, well, we wouldn't want to damage our relationship with Pelosi's office. So it's pretty funny to see how even these outlets that are presumably nonpartisan and unbiased and everything can still, you know, have these type of connections. And then even despite the fact that he said that, and then I later emailed him, or no, I didn't email him. I emailed someone at C-SPAN saying, hey, I was wondering if I could get this footage. And then instead of the person who I sent the message to, instead of them responding, this gentleman who actually approached me about uploading it to YouTube responded, even though, like I said, I hadn't emailed it to him. And he said, you know, we, for whatever reason, we can't do this. And I essentially won the footage over after a long battle saying, you know, C-SPAN's mission is to be objective and unbiased. And that was the whole point of this contest, too, to get all sides of the story and for you to essentially censor or, you know, keep this footage from me, I think, is kind of contradictory to that mission. And I had to send him a USB flash drive, too. I had to send him two because apparently the first one I sent just magically disappeared. So sure. It was just crazy to, it's like the extent you have to go to try to, you know, be persistent and successful to accomplish these things. It's crazy.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's unfortunate that this byproduct of the mainstream media has even permeated C-SPAN, which you're right, was supposed to be even more unbiased and objective than the mainstream media, which now you see these networks kind of carving out left-right niches with Fox and MSNBC. But C-SPAN is actually mostly funded by cable companies in the United States. And I think the cable companies are probably mandated to do that by law. Obviously, C-SPAN is a different kind of resource where you actually can walk away from a couple hours of C-SPAN viewing with a lot more valuable information than, say, Fox or MSNBC or CNN. But it's really this choice of maintaining access over the truth. And that's why it looks like slow pitch softball batting practice a lot of the times, except maybe, obviously, you know, you could see maybe MSNBC having a hard-hitting interview with a Republican congressman like Ron Paul or, you know, vice versa on Fox. But when it comes to maintaining access, you're really not going to see them asking, you're not going to see them asking tough questions. And I always suggest this, this man, Jan Helfelt. Do you know who he is?
No, never heard of him.
He's got a YouTube channel. Jan is J-A-N. It might even be Jan Helfelt. He's what an interview with a politician would look like if the interviewer did not care about maintaining access. He's interviewed Pelosi. He's interviewed a bunch of other pretty well-known senators and congresspeople. And he tries to trap them and he tries to embarrass them. And somehow he's still getting interviews on Capitol Hill. But if people have never seen Helfeld, I recommend that because that's what interviews of politicians in Washington should look like. This is with former governor of New Mexico and presidential candidate Bill Richardson.
You think that all legitimate governmental power is derived from the people?
Absolutely.
Do individual citizens have the right to initiate force against other citizens that haven't initiated force against anybody and haven't violated anybody's property rights and are in their sound mind?
I don't believe citizens have the right to initiate action.
Okay. If they don't have that right to initiate force, can they have properly delegated it to the government?
Well, if they choose to do that, sure.
Can you properly delegate a right that you do not have?
You mean, can you donate property to the government?
No. You've agreed that the citizens don't have the right to initiate force against other citizens.
Right.
Can they, I ask you if they don't have that right, can they properly delegate it to the government? You have said yes. So now I'm asking you whether you can delegate a right that you do not have. Can you properly delegate a right that you do not have? Does that make sense?
I believe under the Constitution, a citizen must obey the laws of their government and their constitutional authority.
But so you think that you can delegate a right that you do not have?
Basically, yes.
Well, I don't have the right to use your home, right? Without your permission.
That's right.
Can I delegate it to my brother or to somebody else?
It's your individual choice.
I could delegate the right to use your home to somebody else? Does that make sense?
If you have a consensual agreement with that other person, it's that right.
Use your home. I don't have a right to use your home, right? Can I delegate that right to somebody else if I don't have it? Don't you have to have the right in order to give it to somebody else?
You can't delegate the use of my home.
Right. So you cannot properly delegate a right that you do not have. You have to have it in order to delegate it. Is that not correct?
I have to go. I got to go.
Now, just back to the question of production, I would be frustrated if something that took so little effort, even though obviously it took a lot of courage to do what you did, reached hundreds of thousands of people, when some of these other videos, and I'm just speaking from my own experience here, that require maybe 10 to 20 to 30, or in your case with the GMO video, 150 hours of work. I've never spent anywhere near that on anything that I've done, I don't think. Tell us, I'm actually interested because some of the things that you do are so involved. I'd like to hear a little bit about your process from deciding something is compelling enough to pursue to getting to the finished product. Do you have a typical procedure that you go through?
Well, you know, being the libertarian I am, I have no, you know, set concrete outline of how to make a video or whatever, but I can sort of speak on the general process I follow. So, the example I'll use is the GMO documentary, I guess. So, firstly, I was actually told by a teacher about this contest. It took me a couple days to, think of like a thesis statement, I guess, for the topic of the video that I wanted. Well, I guess actually for this one in particular, I didn't really have a thesis because it was supposed to be objective. I guess there could be an objective one, but basically the topic that I chose was GMOs. So that I was going to try to investigate anything I could that I could smack or you know, fill into 7 minutes worth of video. Because like I said, that was the requirement for the contest. So first I chose the topic. Then I actually got some help from a classmate. He just did some video and camera work and stuff, just camera work and lighting essentially. And so then after I nailed down the topic, then I contacted some people relevant to the topic being GMOs, like farmers, and trying to get an interview with a farmer in the middle of the winter in Ohio isn't the easiest task, mind you. So farmers, politicians, grocers, doctors, Ben Swan being one of the people too. So got the topic, contacted some people for interviews, and that was probably one of the most difficult parts actually, because people would say, oh sure, I'll do it, and then they'd never call back, or they'd change their mind last minute, or for whatever reason. So then, I wrote up some questions, a list about 15 questions per person, for the interviews once we finally had them scheduled, and, then I did some background research as well during that to kind of coincide with the questions. Then we finally went out and interviewed the people and filmed them and everything, of course. Then we finally took that footage back to my house and on my computer. And then I'd edit the most relevant parts of it, because, mm-hmm. you know, I'd interview them for an hour and a half, and combine that with like the 7 people that I had in the final video. I mean, that's a lot of footage and editing to do. So I'd edit out the most relevant parts, or keep the most relevant parts actually. And then while doing that too, I'd have an outline of the basic, couple topics I wanted to address, which was another difficult part because I just had such little time. And then, after I did that, I'm trying to think. Then, I guess I just edited some more footage then. I had to integrate the excerpts that I chose from the interviews and somehow, make that coherent with a script that I wrote while still being under 7 minutes. Then I went to, my friend's house who helped me with, the camera work and everything. And then we spent a full 12-hour day there, working on the set design that you see in the background of the in-studio mm-hmm. clip, as I like to call it. With all the array of food and Roundup in the background and everything. So that was a 12-hour day. I probably did like 10 takes per like sentence or camera angle or whatever. So that was a long day. And then finally I had to edit all that footage together, color grade everything, add the lower thirds, buy the stock footage that you see, and all that. And meanwhile, my computer was having some issues too. So it was a very extensive process, long story short.
Absolutely. Yeah. The reason why I ask about process is because some of the things that you're doing are incredibly complex, and I'm really impressed with how they come together. A couple of suggestions that I have as far as productivity and project management are concerned, and I suggest these things to everyone that I talk to these days. One is a book called Getting Things Done, and it's about capturing and organizing and executing as far as projects are concerned, like all the individual pieces that make up something complex. And you could, you know, do a couple quick Google searches and learn about the basic flow of getting things done. There's a couple videos. My friend Richard Grove interviewed the author of the book. His name's David Allen. This other program that has really improved my organization is called Evernote. It's free. I don't know if you've ever heard of Evernote.
No.
It's a great way to organize for complex projects like this. And there's even things like a web clipper. So like if I see videos on YouTube that I want, I can clip them into a folder, like a project folder. And it's very easy to make to-do lists, to keep everything together, to cross-reference notes. Those are a couple because I know what you're doing is very complex and involved. And I know you are at this point not relying on your school to educate you in these pursuits, how to manage productivity and how to do more with less stress. Because I also, you know, I know that this kind of work can wear you down a little bit.
Definitely.
You know, you've had some experience with that. Like, oh, my goodness, when is this going to be done? Or am I going to be able to do this?
Yeah. I mean, it's just the work is almost incessant. It's like, it's like when I make a video or something and takes so long to do it or whatever. And then if people want to do interviews, and then like after the Pelosi thing, of course, that was, you know, on a much larger scale than traditional stuff that I do. But it's like I took like a month to get all the video and gather all the stuff that I needed for it. And then, you know, there was a waiting period that I wanted to wait until I was out of school before I released it and stuff like that. And then when the interviews started rolling, I was probably doing like two, maybe three interviews a day for a good week. So I mean, but that's, you know, on the interview side. But on the work side, definitely, it's just like you take so much time to just go, at least for me, I'm a perfectionist, so it's like I take so much time just to do the smallest little thing that probably nobody would ever notice, but it's more of a self-gratification thing than anything, I guess, because it's like I just take so much time to like I said, do the most trivial little things in the video that nobody will see or care about, but, you know, it's just the main reason why I started YouTube, and I might have mentioned this on the other episode that I was in, was kind of to serve as a time capsule that, like I mentioned in the beginning, when I'm in a couple years, or no, maybe that was before we were on air here, but it's like to look back at something you did a couple years ago from the future perspective. It's just entertaining, in my opinion. It's just kind of like watching old family or home movies. You know, it's just, for me, it's just a neat way to reflect on your past.
Yeah, yeah, and I totally understand what you're saying about the gratification and taking a lot of time with like very finite details. And I remember these some of the videos that I've made, like watching them with people, like when I first showed them to people before I posted them to YouTube, and I would be like, now watch what I did here, you know, like things that I know that people probably wouldn't notice,
right,
if I hadn't pointed them out, but were really important to me to get right. So yeah, when it's done, it's a tremendously satisfying feeling. To speak to what you said there at the end, you were on my show 18 months ago before we started recording today. You were saying, oh, yeah, I go back and I look at stuff like that. And how do you feel? Because, I mean, I know you were 15 at the time. I started my show when I was 31. If I go back and look at things that I did in 2009 or 2010, I say, oh, my goodness, that was me. It's hard to believe.
Right.
Not that I wasn't nailing it then, a bunch of stuff anyway, but I was way
There's always room less for development.
Absolutely, absolutely. So when you go back and you listen to the old interviews, which is a good practice, like what did you think of your performance on School Sucks in February of 2013?
You know, it's just interesting. Like some of the questions, I kind of just had like some weird answers to and stuff. Like one of them, your co-host asked me, like, because it was about the pledge video that I made, the Pledge of Disallegiance, and he said, you know, oh, in the morning when you're at school, you know, do you the pledge or whatever? Do you put your hand on your heart and stand up and everything? And I was like, well, maybe I don't say the first couple lines. It's just like, what did that even mean? I don't know. It's just funny to look back, like you said.
Yeah, yeah. I remember we talked about your influences. We talked about the pledge. We talked about eugenics and Monsanto. And I remember talking a little bit about conspiracy theory. And you're a great example of what I've always said is the value of conspiracy theory, is that it can ignite people's curiosity and then, you know, get them doing meaningful work. Because I know I went through a period for a couple of years where I was just completely engrossed in all these videos about 9/11 or these other significant conspiracies, and I wasn't doing anything with it, right? But it had motivated this curiosity and this investigative spirit that ultimately led to me starting my own show and putting it to use in something that was more meaningful with for me anyway, with all the school stuff, because I had 10 years of experience at the time, you know, when I started that. So yeah, the question that I asked was what had changed at school earlier in our discussion, but how about for you personally, has going to school 180 days a year, or even just 5 days a week, as you've learned more, as you've done all this work, like it, I guess it was getting pretty hard a year and a half ago, but for you personally, emotionally, like what is school like these days?
I don't know. It's just kind of, extra work. It's not that I have anything against school per se, other than, you know, the memorization and regurgitation and trivial information, but
yeah.
And you know, I appreciate the sentiment of education and knowledge and everything, because of course that's important, but whether or not people or students, children, kids should be legally restricted to what subjects they can learn about and self-knowledge and everything, I think that's kind of disappointing. And personally, I think my effort and energy could be better utilized on like I said, something that I have a passion for. Not to say I don't care about things that are important, like science and math and stuff like that, but the role that plays in my life right now and, you know, questionably in the future is much different than I see the role of politics or journalism playing in the future in my life.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And one of the reasons why I brought up some tools of organization and productivity is you are about to get into probably your biggest project yet, right, with Politicast.
Right.
Certainly the most complex thing that you've ever done in the realm of media. So let's talk about what Politicast is.
Okay. So Politicast is this new endeavor of mine, and I hope it to be the world's first ever political broadcasting network run entirely by the youth. It's also, you know, said to be run by teenagers, but I kind of use those words interchangeably just because someone's a day over 18 doesn't mean they can't be included. But the basic premise of it, the need for it, is that the youth is the future of our country. And it seems to me right now, you know, being in high school, seeing these things going on, that the youth is incredibly apathetic, specifically toward politics, and it seems like, well, it doesn't really seem like, it's quite obvious that the majority of teenagers are more interested in Justin Bieber and celebrity gossip and video games than they are in, you know, war and economics and government. So,
sure.
So I find that disconcerting, and since the youth, like I said, is the future of the country, this is something that, you know, is incredibly important to me, and I hope to, you know, the means by which I hope to accomplish this is to rent a professional TV studio and then package people with flashy graphics and stuff so as to catch the attention of other teens. We also hope to, you know, integrate some degree of pop culture and music into this as well, so the youth is more interested. But the process by which we're going to do this is twofold, and the first step is getting the handful of teens like myself who are already interested in politics and to get them on the air, get them interested, or not, they're already interested, but to get them on the air, get their opinions out there. And then the second step of that is to package professionally their, you know, opinions and stances on these global issues, and then syndicate that via social media to inactive teens, because we know, you know, teens can't get enough of being on their smartphones and everything. Mm-hmm. So in so doing, we hope to, you know, get more youth involved and knowledgeable, but we also want them to not just do armchair activism. We want them to actually get out in the field. We want to have local contributors here in Cleveland who have access to the studio. We want to have other reporters who can travel across the nation. And then also we want to have international contributors who maybe can't make it to the United States, but if they are interested and they live in, you know, another country, that's completely fine. And then we want to supply them with the tools necessary to go out and get firsthand footage of what's happening. So three examples of those things, I guess, would be a local issue or a local event in Cleveland here in 2016. The RNC is coming to town, so I think that would be a great event to cover. Yeah. A national event, not in Cleveland, that someone could travel to would be the riots in Ferguson right now. That's a very hot button issue. And then lastly, an issue of, you know, global importance, or that international contributors could maybe shed some light on would be, you know, all the troubles in the Middle East, in Gaza, in Iraq, in Syria, etc. So, hopefully the prospect of getting teens, you know, in the spotlight almost and getting their opinions out there to the world, combined with travel and pop culture, hopefully is something that people will be interested in and be able to be engaged with. And also just the last point here is that we want this to be something that's kind of objective, like what C-SPAN's almost supposed to be, in that I acknowledge we all have our personal agendas. I'm a libertarian. Mm-hmm. I don't hide that fact. You know, maybe if I have a good liberal friend, that's great. We want everybody's opinions to get out there, because just kind of viewing these issues from a myopic prism isn't going to solve them. We need to acknowledge everybody's opinions, whether or not we like them. So maybe when I'm on, you know, I push a libertarian agenda. When someone else is on, they push a liberal agenda, whatever. I think that's really important.
Yeah. Oh, that's like a dream of mine, to have a talk show with a liberal and a conservative. I would even settle for just a liberal. Something you said a minute ago about sending reporters places. One of the beautiful things about today's environment that I realized is it, once we kind of build a following, we have correspondents all over the world. You know, and anybody with an iPhone has a decent mobile news setup, right? So you could start, as you build a network, and we talked about this, I've done some work in the past with Tragedy and Hope, and they're based down in Connecticut. And we just said, yeah, we could, you know, we have listeners all over the world, certainly all over the country. I could probably map that, or even just, you know, communicating with people through Facebook, through the group we have. Is anybody near St. Louis? You know, is anybody within a 30-mile radius of Ferguson? If that's something that I wanted to do, if you have a smartphone, you are a news crew.
Right.
Essentially, you might be able to build a network where you just have, you know, a directory of people all over the country who, if they're within 15 or 20 minutes of news happening, they can go and they can get footage that maybe is very different from what you might see in the mainstream media. The other thing, you started describing Politicast, talking about political apathy among teens. And I've always referred to apathy especially political apathy and philosophical apathy, as the third hidden lesson of school. The first one being obedience, the second one being conformity. And intellectual apathy in politics or philosophy is kind of a byproduct of those first two. Obedience is basically trust and obey authority, and conformity is be like everybody else. Well, that produces a kind of intellectual apathy. What kind of thinking do you have to do if you're trying to fit in obey? You know, not much. Mm-hmm. So do you have other sources that you think political apathy among teens might come from?
Well, I think before I go on to that question, to respond to that, I think it's essential to say that if you don't take an interest in politics, they'll take an interest in you. So whether or not you can, you know, take part in politics or care about them intellectually, they will take an interest in you. You know, you're forced to pay taxes and stuff like that. So now as far as from where the apathy stems, I think there's a couple reasons, one of which being the fact that the youth can't vote until they're 18. We're disenfranchised. So the thought process with that is, if I can't vote until I'm 18, why should I bother to understand politics? You know, it's a boring and drab subject and topic, even though it's the ruling force of the world. The second cause would probably be just the bureaucratic language and the complexity of politics. And thirdly, it would probably be, it kind of goes along with that, I guess, but just the fact that the media is so consolidated. You know, 90% of the media is owned by four or five corporations. So the flow of information is just so restricted. And you know, if you watch the media right now, or the mainstream media, you know, maybe in alternative media it's different, but you see the mainstream media, you know, when do you see a voice of youth on TV? You know, rarely ever, if at all. So, you know, like I said, we're the future of the country as the youth, so therefore I think it's just so necessary to get our voice out there. And also, I've kind of forgot to mention the whole, you know, big part of Politicast, which is the Indiegogo campaign that we're doing. And I hate to, you know, pull a plug here, but with Politicast, we're doing crowdfunding right now. And that's a really important part of this, because we need to stay independent. We need to, well, not independent, but we need to stay dependent on our viewers, who are, you know, independent human beings and not these huge corporations that will try to sway or, you know, dictate what we say. So right now we're doing an Indiegogo campaign. It has, like 20 days left, I think. So, we're trying to raise some money for that. And, to go to that campaign, check out the, trailer/promotional video. You can go to igg.me/@, spelled out, not the at symbol, and then another slash, and then Politicast, Politicast. So that's where you can go to check out the campaign page. And even if you can't lend any, you know, monetary help or whatever, even though just, you know, a dollar would help tremendously, if you just leave a comment on the page, leave your feedback, or just share the link with family and friends, it would be greatly appreciated.
Amen. Yeah, no problem plugging that. I mean, this is something that's going to take resources for sure. So, and I'll make sure, I'll put the audio to the video in the final cut of the show. And I'll make sure it's all linked up in the show notes. Absolutely.
Excellent.
So let's talk a little bit about getting active for young people. Now, obviously, yeah, I had a lot of experience working with minorities who had come from the inner city, and I was teaching history, and at the time I was very liberal. And I had lots of stories about how great the government was, and they weren't buying it. Right. Because there was no reason for them to buy into being part of society or being a quote unquote citizen. And one of the topics that we had been exploring on my show recently, I've had this author, Thaddeus Russell, on, who wrote a book called The Renegade History of the United States. And he talked about he has a chapter in his book called The Freedom of Slavery. And one of the things that abolitionists were concerned about prior to the Civil War, this huge population of slaves in the South, they weren't buying into American culture or American society, because why would they? You know, it would almost be insane to do that. And the way to civilize them, or to be able to use them essentially as human resources beyond slavery, was to turn them into citizens. As slaves, they weren't going to buy into American society. By quote unquote freeing them and making them citizens, now you can co-opt them. So I'm talking about all this because of the disengagement, or it's maybe there never really was engagement of the youth, right, in understanding or paying attention to what's happening politically. Kids are blamed for so many things that happen, right? Problems that are related to the schools, or bad parenting, or bad laws, or you know, pharmaceutical drugs. It's blamed on the kids and their inability to handle their music, and their inability to handle their video games, and their oppositional defiant disorder, and their lack of attention to the things that are important. So youth are really scapegoated, and there's been some authors in the past couple of decades. Robert Epstein comes to mind, Bruce Levine, Mike Mayles, who've really put a spotlight on this problem. Yeah, kids can't vote, so why not just, when a problem comes up involving kids, yeah, just blame them. What are they going to do? They can't say anything about it. I think that whether we're talking about inner city minorities, slaves 160 years ago, or youth today, even though all three groups are certainly different, there's no reason why they would buy into the system. There's no reason why they would be interested in what's going on, because it's not for them. I think a lot of kids would be frustrated to learn that they're actually being billed for the political system of today that they're not allowed to participate in.
Exactly.
So when you talk about trying to get young people active, what does getting active mean to you?
Well, getting active, you know, it has a couple different shades of meaning, I guess, one of which being, you know, from your computer, you know, looking up information and acting on that information, hopefully. But I fear that, you know, myself included, from time to time, we don't take action. We just kind of see the information and process it, hopefully, but we don't really take action. So I hope that this idea, this notion of mobilizing and, you know, going around the country and having, and, you know, meeting people from around the world, is kind of appealing to, my generation and the youth. So hopefully, you know, going on scene, seeing these things actually happen, like what's going on in Ferguson, like we mentioned, you know, seeing things firsthand and seeing them online on the computer, I think are two very different things, and I think that will hopefully be something that will, like I said, engage the youth and see how these things, politics in particular, really do affect people, and it's not just some, you know, video game or virtual reality that we see online. It's actual real life that's happening.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And you're kind of suggesting this political engagement more as a self-defense strategy than maybe the suggestion that participating could actually change the system, like voting and running for office.
Yeah, that would be my opinion. But again, you know, I want this to be something that isn't really... the way that I phrase it in the video is, you know, as individuals we're biased, but together our opinions will span the entire political spectrum. So of course that's my stance. I don't think, you know, if, for example, teens were able to vote, that would change anything, because my belief in the Electoral College is probably much different than some of the voters out there. But even so, like I said in the beginning, it's just, you know, the youth is the future of the country, and if we don't begin taking control of our future, I think it'll be looking very gloomy.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you have any programming ideas for Politicast?
Well, as far as shows, I'm not particularly sure. I guess it would really depend on the availability of the studio we could rent and the cost, of course, which is a big part of the fundraising campaign we're doing on Indiegogo. But I kind of have two ideas so far. First, we'd have, the professional studio to work with, and we'd maybe try to do like a weekly or just when we start out, maybe like a monthly thing if we can. And then, of course, once we, get better control and get everything off the ground, then we can, obviously do things more frequently. And then, of course, the second component is doing the traveling reporting and the local reporting as well, and then international contributors as well. So my vision of it right now is we'll have a YouTube page, a YouTube channel, and, we'll do this studio. We'll do like a one-hour studio commentary and just cover some current events. Then we'll have we'll maybe just upload the international contributors' reports by themselves on the YouTube channel as a separate thing, and then we could also do the traveling reporting as well. So hopefully those are, again, some things that will engage the youth, and we'll also have people on for interviews too, just because the broadcast network is run by teens doesn't mean we can't have adults on for interviews or stuff like that, because obviously, most of them have a little bit more experience than us as the youth and have some more wisdom to share and knowledge. So I don't want to, restrict the interviewees to just youth as well.
Great. Absolutely. And that I think would make for some really interesting interactions. Maybe you could even get like kind of a South Park dynamic going on, where the kids are clearly more informed and rational than the adults.
Yeah, maybe we wouldn't even have to, pretend to do that. Maybe it would just actually happen, but we'll see.
All right, so before I let you go, can you just give us the details again on the Indiegogo campaign and finally how people can find your work on YouTube, Andrew?
Definitely. So the Indiegogo campaign is igg.me/@AT/Politicast, PoliticaCast. Mm-hmm. And if you're having trouble using that link or if that's not working for whatever reason, you can also go to Indiegogo.com. Indie is spelled INDIE and then GOGO. And if you just go there, you can search for Politicast. And if that fails, you can also go to youtube.com/teentake, TEENTAKE, and you'll see the Politicast trailer. And then in the description of that video, there will be a link to the Indiegogo campaign, and there will also be an annotation on the video. So hopefully one of those methods will work for you.
All right, great. So let's not wait a year and a half to check in with each other next time. And I highly recommend that people go and check out your videos. The production quality is outstanding. And I wish you the best of luck with this, Andrew. I think this is an awesome project. I'm really excited about it. And let's say we'll follow up in a few months and see where things are at.
Yeah, sounds good, Brett. Thanks for having me on. And just in closing, I'd like to say, as far as the Indiegogo campaign, again, remember, we just need a little help from a lot of people. We don't need, hundreds of dollars. Just, donate a little if you can. If not, just leave a comment, leave your feedback, and share it with some friends and family.
Yes. If you don't have the money, definitely try to spread the word.
Definitely.
Because the money's out there. You just have to get it in front of enough eyes. All right, Andrew, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brett. Good to be on.